Okay. So last time, of the three major outlines, the preliminary, the main body, and the conclusion, last time we covered the preliminaries. Okay? And so we talked about the praise, which was the first line, I bow down to the Venerable Spiritual Masters. And we talked about the pledge to compose, which was the first complete verse. And we talked about the encouragement to the reader to pay attention, which was the second verse. Okay, so with the third verse, we're starting the main body of the text, which was the second point, main point on the whole outline. You with me? Okay, we had the three main points of the preliminary, the main body, and the conclusion. So we finished the first one, which was the preliminary that had three subdivisions. And now we're going to start the second one, the main body of the text. Okay? And this one, the main body of the text, has four subdivisions. It can be very helpful to you. What I often do is go back and write out the outline in outline form, and then put each verse by the point in the outline that it goes with, because then it helps us really understand what each verse is talking about. Okay, so with the main body of the text, there's four outlines. The first one of those is the explanation of renunciation. The second is the explanation of bodhicitta. The third is the explanation of the correct view. And the fourth is strong words of encouragement, so that the reader recognizes the truth of the instructions and puts them into practice. Okay, so back to the first point of the main body, the explanation of renunciation. So that has three subpoints. Okay, three subpoints under renunciation. The first one is the reason why we should develop it. The second is how to develop it. And the third is the point at which we can say that we have developed it, that we've been successful at that. Okay, so the first point under renunciation, the reason why we should develop renunciation, that is verse 3. Okay, so verse 3 reads, "For you embodied beings, bound by the craving for existence, without the pure determination to be free, or renunciation, from the ocean of cyclic existence, there is no way for you to pacify the attractions to its pleasurable effects. Thus, from the outset, seek to generate the determination to be free." Okay. So this is explaining the reason why we need to generate renunciation, or the determination to be free. Why? Because if we don't have renunciation, then there's no way for us to pacify the attractions to the pleasurable effects of samsara. In other words, if we think that there's some happiness to be got in samsara, then, we'll go for that rather than go for liberation or enlightenment. Okay? So it's like somebody who's in prison. Unless they see the disadvantages of prison, they're not going to have any, wish to be out of prison. So if you're in prison and instead you think of all the good qualities of being in prison, three hot meals, I don't have to work, I have a bed to sleep in. If you think like this, then prison seems very comfortable. And then you have, why should I try and get out of prison? It's actually quite comfy in here. Yeah. So if you think like that, then you have no interest or impetus to get out, so then you spend your whole life in prison. So it's the same way. As long as we think that there's happiness in cyclic existence, then we have no interest in getting out, and as a result, then we just stay in cyclic existence. Okay? So that's like, the prisoner stays in prison. And they don't see, they have no freedom. They're treated like an infant. They're bossed around. They can't get a good education. It's totally noisy. There's all these obstacles to so many things you want to do. But until they see all that, you know, then they're stuck in the middle of it because they don't want to get out. So it's a similar thing. As long as we think cyclic existence is nice, then yeah, let's hang around. It's no problem. Okay? So, you know, what we're trying to do with renunciation is see the faults of cyclic existence, because that gives us the energy to change the situation. And this is actually one of the most, most difficult things for us to see in our practice, because at some level, you know, we have some renunciation, otherwise we wouldn't be living here at the monastery. So we have some feeling that, yes, I want to get out of cyclic existence. But then, and that got us here, you know, to the monastery. But then if we look kind of day to day, you know, when we wake up in the morning, is our first thought, you know, I want to get out of cyclic existence, and I want other sentient beings to get out of cyclic existence? Or is our first thought mainly, how can I have pleasure while I'm in cyclic existence? You know? What are most of our thoughts in the day concerning? Is it how to get out of samsara, or is it how to get some pleasure in samsara? No? So this is a little homework assignment for you, okay? To do a little review and watch your thoughts and see, you know, how many of my thoughts are thoughts concerned with renunciation and bodhicitta, and how many thoughts are thoughts of how I can have pleasure, you know? So that can mean pleasure in this life, and it can also mean pleasure in future lives, you know? But our whole mind that just thinks, you know, wake up in the morning, oh, my bed's so comfy, I don't want to get out, you know? Or what good food can I eat today? Or what nice people can I be with today? Or how can I, you know, avoid doing unpleasant things today? No. Like kind of what are most of our thoughts involved with? You know, is it renunciation, or is it, you know, we're attracted to the pleasurable effects of cyclic existence? Okay, so do a little research and watch your mind and see what goes on. But the phrase in here that always strikes me, you know, the beginning when it says, for you embodied beings bound by the craving for existence. You know, to me just that phrase, and especially the words embodied beings. I mean, that's what we are. We're embodied beings. We're beings with a body. Well, what does that mean to be an embodied being? Well, it means having a body that, you know, has gotten born, and then gets old and sick and dies. Yeah. And there's this whole movement in America, you know, body is beautiful, and, you know, be in our body and love your body and all of this stuff. And that, you know, there's certain points of that, I think, that are valid, because we don't want to hate our body, because hating our body means that we're just as wrapped up with it as indulging our body. Okay, so it's not a question of hating our body and despising it, but when we see what it means to be embodied, you know, what just by the fact of taking a body that gets old and sick and dies, what is our life going to be about? You know, just by the fact of getting born with this body, what are we already directed or impelled to do? Well, just by having this body and by craving for the existence of this body, then we have to put so much energy into protecting it and keeping it healthy. Then we get attached to it. We want it to look beautiful. And, you know, we get attracted to other people's bodies. And then we get afraid of getting old because our body gets ugly and it gets sick. And we get afraid of dying. And so all these fears, you know, just run through our mind so much because we are embodied beings, you know, fears of things going wrong with our body. And then we generate so much of our personal identity based on our body. Yeah? Whatever nationality we are, whatever ethnicity we are, whatever race we are, whatever gender we are, whatever sexual orientation we are, all these things are based on the body. And just by having this body, then we get caught up in all those other identities. And then, of course, that puts us in conflict with other people who have other identities based on their bodies, which are different than our bodies. Okay? So just by having a body, I mean, already we're just so predisposed towards so much suffering, just the physical suffering of the body, the mental suffering of, you know, the fearing aging, sickness, and death, the mental suffering of being attached to identities based on our body, the mental suffering of quarreling with other people who have other identities based on their bodies. Okay? So just the expression embodied beings, it's like, blech, that's unsatisfactory. Yeah? And, you know, I think all this talk that we have in America about, you know, how wonderful your body is and love your body and all of that, I think, yeah, I mean, that talk is very clearly given because people don't see any alternative to having a contaminated body. You know, when we don't know anything about Dharma, in our mind, there's no alternative to conceptualize existence. You know, you never think of having a body made of light, like an arhat. You never think of having a body, you know, that's under the influence of compassion, like a bodhisattva. You never think of having a body that's made of the purified winds that can manifest in any kind of form to benefit sentient beings, like a Buddha. You know, when people who don't know about Dharma don't see any alternative to having this kind of body. So when you're stuck with that worldview, then, you know, you have to say, love your body and feel good, because otherwise, if you look at the truth of what this body is, you just get depressed because you don't see any recourse to it. But I think what the Buddha was trying to do in getting us to look at the nature of this body, you know, how it's impermanent, how it's suffering in nature, is not just to get us depressed, because, you know, we can do that by ourselves, but to say we don't have to be embodied beings with this kind of body. There is another alternative. You know, we take this body under the influence of ignorance and karma. But we don't have to be ignorant and create karma, so we don't have to take this body. And there is another way to exist, you know, besides contaminated existence. So I think, you know, the Buddha discovering that and then teaching us is giving us a whole new view about what life can be, you know, and what our potential is. Okay? Because if you look at it, you know, we're embodied beings craving for existence. Okay? Craving for existence. That's what we do, don't we? You know, I crave to have my ego identity. And my ego identity is based on this body. So I crave for this body. And then once I have this body, I want it to be happy. So then I crave for glazed donuts and, you know, and seaweed and Chinese buns and, you know, whatever it is. You know, we crave for some kind of pleasure. And then, you know, all of our other cravings jump in, and then our mind just gets so tangled up because we can't always get what we want, so then we get miserable. Yeah? So just that phrase, embodied beings bound by the craving for existence. I mean, to me, when I think very deeply about that phrase, just what that means is like, ugh, you know, I want out of that. You know, so that's what renunciation is. It's like, I want out. There is something more to life than just living like that. You know, we do have other potentials. Okay, so, but without seeing that we're embodied beings with, you know, bound by the craving for existence, without seeing ourselves that way, you know, then we just have our normal kind of view of, well, I'm just little old me bopping around here, and the purpose of my life is have pleasure. Yeah, to be happy. And so sometimes we get happiness by sense pleasure, sometimes we get happiness by, you know, thinking we're important because we help other people. You know, there's all different sorts of ways that our ego gets happiness, but we get totally bound up in all of that selfishness and ignorance. Okay. So the way for us to get out is to see the unpleasurable effects of samsara, to see its suffering nature. Okay, and we'll get into that a little bit later on, you know, in the following verses of how to see the suffering nature of samsara. But when we do that, then, you know, we're no longer interested in, you know, just twiddling our thumbs and trying to get class B pleasure when we can have class A and class double A pleasure, you know, that comes from Dharma practice. And what's interesting is, you know, that the pleasure from Dharma practice comes from seeing, from renouncing the pleasure of cyclic existence, because we see that pleasure as small and inadequate. Okay, so that verse 3 is talking about why we should generate renunciation and why it's important, you know, why Lama Tsongkhapa says, from the outset, seek to generate the determination to be free. He doesn't say from the outset, generate the correct view, or from the outset, generate bodhicitta. He doesn't say that. He says from the outset, you know, seek to generate the determination to be free, because that being fed up with the limitations of our present existence is the thing that spurs us into Dharma practice. Without that, you know, our bodhicitta isn't real bodhicitta, and our, you know, and we have no inspiration to gain the correct view either. Because the whole reason to gain the correct view isn't for intellectual knowledge, it's to get ourselves out of cyclic existence. So if we don't see anything wrong with cyclic existence, why generate the correct view? So difficult. Okay? And if we don't have any impetus to get ourselves out of cyclic existence, how in the world are we going to have bodhicitta that wants others to get out of cyclic existence? You know, we're not going to have that either. So, you know, this determination to be free is really essential. That's why he says generate it at the outset. Of course, you know, many people in the West, when they come to the teachings, this they don't want to hear about this, you know? Kind of all the disadvantages of cyclic existence. You know what I just said about, you know, the faults of being embodied beings with this body that's limited? People don't want to hear that nowadays, you know? People want to hear how to have your body, how to have sense pleasure with your body, and how to avoid all the problems of having a body. You know, oh, how are you going to do that? Yeah? And so that's why, you know, people want science, and because they think science will be able to reverse sickness and aging. And the whole thing of what's cryogenics, where you freeze your dead body in the hopes that it can be rejuvenated later by science, that's done to, you know, avoid the suffering of death. And so, you know, so people want that. You know, instead of really, you know, how to avoid taking this body and getting ourselves into this predicament to start with. You know, and then people say, oh, meditating on renunciation is so miserable. I have to think of suffering and, you know, how unsatisfactory my life is, and that makes me so depressed. Actually, personally speaking, I found that all those meditations about the unsatisfactory nature of samsara, I found them a total relief. You know, because finally, here was a place where I could admit that, yeah, my life isn't completely satisfactory. Because before that, there's all this pressure, you know. Oh, yeah, my life is great. My life is wonderful. Everything's going great, you know. When it isn't at all. And so I found the Buddha's teachings just, whew, okay, I can admit I have problems. Finally, that's good. Okay. So, from the outset, generate the determination to be free. It's really, really important. Okay, and it gives us a lot of energy in our practice. Okay, then the second part of the outline for renunciation was how to develop it. Okay, so how to develop it is explained in verse 4. So verse 4 says, by contemplating the leisure and endowment so difficult to find and the fleeting nature of your life, reverse the clinging to this life. By repeatedly contemplating the infallible effects of karma and the miseries of cyclic existence, reverse the clinging to future lives. Okay, So, this second outline, How to Develop Renunciation, it actually has two parts itself. And the first is how to develop renunciation for this life. So that's that first sentence. And then the second one is how to generate renunciation for future lives, and that's the second sentence. Okay, so verse 4 contains, you know, how to develop renunciation first for the present life, and then second for the future life. So let's look into the first part, okay, how to stop the craving and clinging for this life. Okay? How do we do that? Okay, well, first of all, what is the craving and clinging for this life? What is it? Yeah. It basically boils down to the eight worldly concerns. Okay, when we talk about the craving and clinging for this life, it's being attached to the happiness of this life. In other words, the eight worldly concerns. So let's take a look at these eight worldly concerns. They're very, very important, and they're very embarrassing. Okay? So the eight, they go into four pairs, okay? First pair is feeling happy when we get material things or money, and then feeling unhappy when we don't get them or when we lose them. And then the second pair is feeling happy when we're praised and, you know, people approve of us and speak very nicely and sweetly to us. And then the converse, being unhappy when we're criticized, when we hear words that are displeasing to our ego, when we're blamed, when people don't approve of us. The fourth pair is being pleased when we have a good image and a good reputation, when kind of we're famous and people know about us. And then the converse, feeling unhappy when we have a bad image and a bad reputation. And then the fourth pair is feeling happy when we have any kind of sense pleasure, you know, from things we see or hear, smell, taste, or touch. And being unhappy when we have unpleasant sensual experiences. Okay, so those are the eight worldly dharmas. Let's go over these because this is so essential. And when I first learned the Dharma, Zopa Rinpoche, he would teach a whole month-long meditation course on these eight worldly concerns, again and again and again and again, going over them, until he kind of knocked it into our heads that this was a really important topic. And it is, because whenever we do something motivated by one of the eight worldly concerns, that action produces the result of cyclic existence. Okay? Whenever we do an action that's not motivated by the eight worldly concerns, that will produce a result of liberation and enlightenment. Okay? So this demarcation between what's dharma and what's worldly is based on whether we're motivated by the eight worldly concerns or not. Okay? Even to get a good future rebirth, we have to abandon the eight worldly concerns. Okay? Let alone liberation and enlightenment, even the lowest dharma aim, to get that, we have to give up the eight worldly concerns. But I don't know about you, when I look at my life is 100% involved in the eight worldly concerns. No. Okay? So let's look at them. Feeling delight when we get money or material things. Right? Okay? We all, now we might think, oh, I have no attachment for money and material things. Well, just think how much time we spend worrying about if we have enough money or not. And do we ever have enough money where we're ever going to feel secure? Yeah. And think of the worry we have of, you know, well, what happens? You know, we're monastics and we depend on lay people. What happens if they don't bring us stuff? Or what happens if our monastery doesn't have money and we can't get the things that we need? Okay? So we might think that we don't care about money and possessions, but we really do. Yeah. I mean, even very simple things. And like our shoes, you know, we might think, I have no attachment for my shoes. Sure, anybody who wants can have my shoes. I'm not attached to them. But, you know, if we walk out of this meditation hall and we go and we look and our shoes aren't there and somebody took our shoes, we're going to be upset, aren't we? That actually happened one time. Somebody came to visit me when I lived in Singapore. I was staying at someone's flat, and he came to see me. He left his shoes outside the door, and when he went to leave, his shoes were gone. Somebody had stolen his shoes. And that's happened to me when I've been at the stupa in Bodh Gaya, where I left my shoes outside, and I came back, and they were just plastic shoes. But my cheap plastic shoes, you know, but my shoes were gone. And your mind, it's incredible what your mind does. Somebody took my shoes. Then I have to walk back barefoot, and it's over this gravel, and it hurts. You know, how dare somebody take my shoes, and now my feet are going to hurt so much, and I don't want that. You know, so we have this intellectual idea, oh, I don't care about material things, but as soon as somebody takes something, we freak out. You know, we get really upset. Now, if we all went back to our room you know, after this class, and even, you know, even somebody had taken our Buddha statue, even a holy object. Somebody took my Buddha statue. You know, how dare they? Or somebody takes our clothes. Oh, you took my clothes. No? Or, you know, anybody just goes and takes our stuff. We don't like it. Or somebody comes along and asks us for something. And we always think, oh, I'm so generous, but somebody comes and asks us for something, and I don't want to give it. Yeah? I mean, you see this incredible, like, you know, you get a snack, and let's say somebody, I mean, this happens in India all the time, and this is an advantage of living in India, you know. You're sitting on a train eating, and there's a beggar who comes and says, give me something. And you watch your mind go, no, I don't want to give it. I want this food for myself. Yeah? And yet we always think, oh, I'm not attached to food. Sure, I can give everything away. Yeah? So it's real interesting, you know, to just watch our mind and the worry we have about possessions and money, you know, how we react when somebody asks us for something, how we react when somebody takes our stuff. Yeah? And then we see if you know, our intellectual concept of how renounced we are actually meets, you know, fits the reality of how we act. Hmm? Yeah. Go back in your room and somebody took your blanket. No blanket, it's cold. I don't want to be cold at night. How dare somebody take my blanket? Okay? So the thing is, the more attached we are to something, the more aversion and anger and upset we have when we lose it. So these pairs, you know, the attachment to money and material possessions and the dislike of losing them, these two go right together. If you have one, you're going to have the other. Okay? So it's just very interesting to check up. Mm-hmm. Like at DFF, you know, when I ask people to go home and clean out their closets and give away the things that they don't use, they found it so hard. You know, even though they don't use the things, to go through the closets and give things away. I don't want to give that away. I might need it in the future. Or, oh, my relative gave me that. It has so much sentimental value. I don't want to give it away. You know, we find it really hard to give away stuff, even if we don't use it. Uh-huh. So that shows that we're involved with these eight worldly concerns. It's, you know, it's right there. Okay, then the second pair with the eight worldly concerns, attachment to praise and sweet words and approval and dislike, you know, of disapproval and blame and, you know, unkind words. This one's even harder than, you know, giving up money and material possessions is easy compared to giving up attachment for praise and sweet words. Yeah, because and just look at it, like especially if we look at our moods on a day-to-day basis, and just my moods in one day, how we go up and down in one day. Somebody comes in and says, oh, thank you for doing this. Oh, I feel good. Somebody recognized that I did my job well, you know? And we feel quite happy. And then the next person comes in and says, why didn't you do that? And then we feel, oh, they're criticizing me. And we feel down, or we get angry. They're criticizing me. How dare they do that? Yeah. And then the next person comes in and says, oh, you're so kind. Then we feel very happy. You know, that person's my friend. And the next person comes in and says, you're so sloppy in your speech. You know, I thought you were a Dharma practitioner. Why are you talking like that? And then we get really unhappy and we feel miserable because we got criticized. Huh? Or somebody says, oh, you're so wonderful for practicing the Dharma. I admire you so much. You're such a good practitioner. We feel, oh, yes, very happy. And then the next person comes along and says, you call yourself a Dharma practitioner? What in the world are you doing? You know, you're so full of attachment. Then we feel really insulted. We feel angry. We get depressed. Yeah, we attack back at the other person. So it's just, it's incredible, you know, on a day-to-day basis to watch our moods, and especially how they stem, how reactive we are to the words other people say to us. Absolutely incredible, you know, how reactive and how our mind goes, that person doesn't like me, oh no, and we blame ourselves, or that person doesn't like me, what's wrong with them, you know, or I mean, just we're so reactive, you know, and our moods go up and down, and just how we speak to other people. People praise us, so of course we speak nicely back to us. Somebody else points out our fault, and even if it's a fault that's true, and we know we have it, you know, we get mad. Yeah? Somebody says, you know, you're always late, or somebody says, you know, you always do this or that or the other thing. And it's true, we always do. But we go, you know. It's like nobody's supposed to notice my faults. And if you notice my faults, you're not supposed to say them. Okay? And we're just so reactive. Now we anger so quickly, or we get depressed so quickly. So this is all just this part of the eight worldly concerns, you know, attachment to sweet words and praise and approval, and not liking getting blamed and people disapproving us and people saying unkind things to us, you know. I mean, this is like, and I watch, you know, my own mind, and this is, you know, eight worldly concerns, like I was saying, this is the demarcation line between a Dharma action and a non-Dharma action. So eight worldly concerns, this is Buddhism 101. It's like the first thing we got to start working with are the eight worldly concerns. But I look at my own life and how out of whack I get when people criticize me, you know? How unhappy my mind gets when I get criticized, how angry I get, how I, you know, I fall back into all these old patterns of somebody's angry at me, so I just shut up, and then I'm depressed and I hold it all inside, but inside my mind I'm just saying all these nasty things about them, but I don't want to say it out loud, because if I say it out loud then they'll attack me more, and then my whole mind's just a mess, and it's all this set of the eight worldly concerns, praise and blame, all just that, you know? And yet, you know, here have a precious human life, so much possibility to practice the Dharma, and yet the mind just stays ruminating around about these eight worldly concerns again and again and again, you know? This person said this, maybe I don't belong here, they don't like me, what did I do wrong? You know, everybody's always saying this about me, who do they think they are anyway? You know, the pot shouldn't call the kettle black, and, you know, I'm going to tell them the right, you know, tell them that they do the exact thing. Say it out loud, because if I say it out loud, then they'll attack me more, and then my whole mind's just a mess. And it's all this set of the eight worldly concerns, praise and blame. All just that, you know? And yet, you know, here have a precious human life, so much possibility to practice the Dharma, and yet the mind just stays ruminating around about these eight worldly concerns again and again and again, you know? This person said this, maybe I don't belong here, they don't like me, what did I do wrong? You know, everybody's always saying this about me, who do they think they are anyway? You know, the pot shouldn't call the kettle black, and, you know, I'm going to tell them the right, you know, tell them that they do the exact same thing, put them in their place, and, you know, we plan out all this thing that we want to say to them, and, you know, just eight worldly concerns. Then the third pair, okay, is attachment to a good reputation and image and aversion to having a bad reputation and image. Okay, so that's, this one's like fame and notoriety. So this is different than praise, the previous one of praise and blame, because praise and blame is more what an individual says to you. Okay, this one about reputation, good reputation, bad reputation, is your image amongst a whole group of people. Okay, so it's different. So we might think, I don't want to be famous. You know, I'm not looking to be George Bush or Madonna or somebody like that. I'm not hung up on fame. But if we look again in our lives, we all have our own little sphere of influence. You know, our own little groups, and within our own little groups, we want to have a good reputation. We want people to think well of us. Okay? So no matter, you know, what our little group is, yeah, I mean, like people who have hobbies, you know, let's say they're on the swim team. Everybody who's on the swim team, they want to have a good reputation with everybody else who's on the swim team. Yeah? So you're attached to your reputation, what all your teammates think about you. Yeah, we come and we're in the monastery. Well, we're attached to, you know, well, what do all the other Buddhists think about me? Do I have a good reputation with the lay people? Do I have a good reputation in the Buddhist organization? You know, do they write about me and mention my name in Buddhist magazines? Yeah, or do they mention my teacher's name in Buddhist magazines? Because if my teacher's famous and I'm attached to my teacher, then I get a little bit of a good reputation too. Yeah, and you know, so whatever it is, whatever subgroup we're in, we want a good reputation within that. You know, if you play basketball, you want, you know, even if it's just with all the other people on your block, you want a good reputation with the people on your block. Yeah? So, again, we can get so bent out of shape when we don't have a good reputation, when our image is ruined, when we're trying to present this image, even of a Dharma practitioner, here I am, I'm a very good Dharma practitioner, and then, you know, all of our faults show forth, and then people talk about us behind our back, and our reputation is ruined, and we go, that can't happen, you know? Everybody's supposed to think I'm such a good practitioner. And, you know, all that upset happens basically because we're attached to reputation, which is a worldly concern. Yeah? And it happens all the time. I mean, this thing is really deep-rooted. And in fact, they often say that getting rid of this one about, you know, these two sets, the one about praise and blame and the one about reputation, that this is much harder than overcoming attachment to food and clothing and, you know, comfort of our body. Because they say, you know, you can go up and, you know, the ideal in Tibet, you know, you go up and meditate in a cave and you just eat, you know, very meager food and you're sleeping on the rock and, you know, you have, you know, very simple torn clothes, but in your mind you're thinking, I hope everybody down in the town is thinking about what a great and renounced meditator I am. Yeah? So you can see, I mean, they even point this out specifically in the scriptures. I mean, how difficult it is to give up our attachment to our reputation and to being well known and wanting people to think well of us. You know, because we even want a good reputation for being ascetic, huh? Which is like, you know, totally contradictory, isn't it? Okay, so, you know, and then all the things that we do to get a good reputation, you know, how we butter up certain people and we do actions that are going to win us brownie points so that we look good and we make sure other people know what we did. And then, you know, when we don't have a good reputation and people are gossiping about us behind our back, you know, we hate that, and so then we want to get even, so we gossip behind their back and we say nasty things about them. You know, it just causes so many problems in our life, you know. Similar to the previous one, you know, with the praise and blame, you know, what do we do to get the praise? You know, we sometimes we act in a certain way that's really insincere just so somebody will praise us. Yeah, we'll even contradict our own ethical principles because we want certain people to like us and think well of us. Yeah, so we succumb to peer pressure. You know, we do all sorts of things to get other people's approval. Yeah? And even, like, even if, let's say there's people we care about who think that we're stupid for practicing Dharma, then we'll even give up our Dharma practice so that those people will think well of us. Yeah? Because we just want people to praise us, you know. And then when we get blamed, you know, we get involved in, you know, creating so many negative actions too, yeah. So it's eight worldly concerns. It's just totally amazing how this runs our life and creates so much suffering for us. And then the fourth set is, you know, feeling pleased at different sense pleasures and unhappy with other sense pleasures. So just how, you know, on a day-to-day basis, we're on the lookout for good sense pleasures, you know. So we're on the lookout, what nice things can I look at, you know. I want to have a nice picture in my room. I want the, you know, the meditation room to be painted a certain color because I think that color is nice, yeah. I want to listen to nice music, you know, or I don't want to listen to this other kind of music and, you know. One person says, I like wind chimes, and the other person says, I don't like wind chimes, you know, and we're just all involved in that. And then, you know, what we smell, you know, I want to smell nice things, so, you know, we have to put, you know, all this fragrance in the bathroom, which I think smells worse, you know. But, and then, you know, we don't like bad smells. And then food, you know, we're so attached to food, gotta cook such nice food, and, you know, taste well, and, you know, plenty of it. All very attached to food. And then, you know, tactile things, you know, we don't like, you know, if we're too cold, we're unhappy. If we're too hot, we're unhappy. You know, if our bed's too hard, we complain. If our bed's too soft, we complain. You know, we like the feeling of people touching us, you know, the whole sexual experience, this tactile sensation. You know, so what we do to kind of get all these very pleasant sensations, and how much of our mental energy is consumed with arranging our life so that we can get these pleasures. And what's even trickier is when we're Dharma practitioners, we try to arrange our life so we get these pleasures without making it look like we're arranging our life so that we get these pleasures. Because if people know that we're trying to get these pleasures, then we get a bad reputation because that's not a Dharma practice. Okay, but our mind's still involved with all of this, so we're trying to, you know, get all these things that give us the happiness of this life, but without actually acknowledging that we're attached to these things and making it look like it's some other, you know, Dharma reason or something like that. Okay, so the mind is so sneaky. You know, incredibly sneaky, how our mind just contorts our motivation and makes up reasons and excuses and lies and all sorts of stuff so that we can get the four things of the eight worldly concerns and so that we can avoid the other four or get revenge when we get them, you know. So when we lose our possessions, when we people criticize us, when they talk behind our back and give us a bad reputation, when we don't get the sense pleasures we want, you know, how can I retaliate? How can I get even, you know? So sometimes we criticize those people, sometimes we go around with a unhappy face, you know, I'm mad at you, you know, you cook the food you know I don't like, and, you know, we just, our mind just gets so so wrapped up. And all it is, if we think about it, is attachment to the happiness of this life. And this life is so short, and these pleasures are so short, what's the use of being so attached to them? It's like, you know, we have a good lunch. Well, lunch is finished in a half an hour, and it's done. And, you know, do you even remember what you ate last Monday? Let alone a year ago? Let alone 5 years ago? I mean, we don't even remember what we ate. The pleasure is so short-lived, and yet, you know, we spend so much time, you know, trying to get it and then being unhappy if we don't get it. Yeah? And so we can look so much with these eight worldly concerns. All the things that we do to, you know, get people's praise and get them to like us. And, you know, we really don't care about them, but we pretend to do nice things so that they'll like us and praise us. And then we can't acknowledge it to ourselves that we're really doing it with a bad motivation, and we think, actually, I'm so compassionate, look what I'm doing for this person. But actually, our real motivation is that we want them to like us and to talk nice about us. But we can't acknowledge it to ourselves or to them, you know. So we make up our Dharma motivation of how compassionate we are, and we believe it. And yet if we're really honest with ourselves, it's just eight worldly concerns. Yeah? I mean, this is why I said it's embarrassing. Yeah? But I mean, and I know, because my teacher emphasized this so much, I mean, how important this topic is. And this is really the